Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is August 31st, 2013, here across the Dateline in Japan. And joining me on the line once again from Australia is our old friend Brock West of APPerspective.net for our monthly series, The Asia-Pacific Perspective, where we take a look at all of the information that's spilling out forth through the news wires across the Asia-Pacific region. Brock, always great to have you on. Thanks for joining us again.
James, it's always a pleasure to be with you and good to be back with you so soon.
Well, it is quite soon since our last conversation, but there is so much to talk about. So why don't we get straight into the first story?
Absolutely, James. And you'd have to be hard-pressed to not know about what's going on in Syria right now. But a question that I'm getting quite a lot through the contact form at APPerspective.net is, you know, what is Australia's stance on Syria? And, you know, what how does this part of the world feel about the situation in Syria? And I will go into that a little bit more, especially as we do have an election looming here, but let's first take our first story from the lowyinterpreter.org, and the headline reads, "As Australia takes UN Security Council reins, not only Syria on the agenda." Quote, "Australia, which presided over the first ever meeting of the UN Security Council in January 1946, will take the reins of the 15-nation body for the ninth time next month as the crisis in Syria nears its tipping point. But Ambassador Gary Quinlan will rule over the deadlock council, and while Australia will reportedly seek to use its presidency to push for a solution to the Syrian crisis, in reality, the mantle of the presidency brings with it little to no power to influence the council's actions. The president represents the council, and Ambassador Quinlan will be expected to brief reporters outside the Security Council chambers several times weekly during the month. The president also sets a daily agenda of the council, and this is one area where Australia may have some leeway. For example, if another council member seeks an urgent meeting, it is up to the president to call that meeting. Russia and China have vetoed three previous draft resolutions, the last in July 2012, that would have imposed tough measures against the Assad regime. Non-permanent members, Azerbaijan and Pakistan, also abstained on the July 2012 vote. A fourth attempt by the P3, which includes Britain, France and the US, is seeking council approval for action against Assad, but is all but assured to fail. James, this is obviously quite a developing story, and I just want to firstly point people to your excellent work that you did with the latest Eye Opener report and also podcast, where you can really get, you know, into the nitty-gritty of the Syrian situation. But from the Australian perspective, James, as I said, we are a week out from an election here, so the last thing that both of our ruling parties want is Australia involved in yet another extremely unjust and unpopular war of aggression. Perhaps if we were in the midterm, it might be a little bit different, but so far Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has taken a fairly cautious approach when speaking on the Syrian situation, saying relatively sane things like, you know, we need to know all the facts before any decision is made. On the flip side, his counterpart, and to be honest, most likely Australia's next Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, has pretty much echoed the sentiments of UK Defence Minister William Hague, also coming out during the week stating that one of his first things, if he is elected into office, is to further strengthen Australia's ties with Israel. So he's definitely starting to show his true colours there, and not that Rudd or Gillard before him were unsympathetic to Israel's plight, but it's quite telling to see this coming out from opposition leader Tony Abbott. However, during the week, as the Syrian bloodlust was reaching its peak, Prime Minister Rudd did suspend his campaign to talk to Obama on the crisis, which who knows what was said in reality, but if I may take a brief guess, I'll say that President Obama would just be making sure that no matter which way the chips fall on Syria, that Australia plays US ball when presiding over the UN Security Council. James?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think any of this should come as a surprise. I mean, Australia is just basically an adjunct to U.S. Military power in the Asia-Pacific region and is more than happy to go along with any American military adventurism. I mean, going back, I mean, even Vietnam and places like that, Australia happy to commit troops. So I'm sure that we will continue to see that in the future. I don't think there will be any significant break. It is interesting to see that as elections come up, seems to be the only time that politicians are actually sensitive to the public opinion on matters like this. So at least you guys are saved, I guess, by the fact that you've got an election coming up and no one wants to stick their neck out during that time. So perhaps that's staved off some of the Syrian itchy trigger finger that people have at this point.
Yeah, so exactly right. And essentially, that's from what I've gathered, Australia's political stance on Syria in a brief nutshell. You know, any potential bombing or military action in Syria is as unpopular here as it is around the rest of the globe. So as we sit here on the last day of August, it seems for at least a brief moment that some sanity has prevailed with the British Parliament voting it down. So, James, with the our next story will cover the G20, but with the G20 upon us, how do you see this playing out in the immediate future, considering Russia and China's strong opposition to the strikes?
Well, that's still the critical issue in the UN, and I think it's just an extremely tricky issue for the US to negotiate. And I really do think there's a window of opportunity for these strikes that's closing, because I can't imagine that they're going to go ahead with Obama out of the country. So I think it's going to happen in the next few days, if it's going to happen, and it could potentially start something quite severe. And in fact, Russia has apparently been positioning some warships in the Mediterranean, which would make it an even stickier situation. Plus the fact that we're now getting reports that Russia is prepared to retaliate against Saudi Arabia if these strikes go ahead. And that has to do with the Prince Bandar connection, which is just a fascinating part of this whole tale. But again, that's covered in my podcast, so people can go there for more information on that. But yes, a very, very sticky situation, only complicated by the G20 coming up next week.
Yeah, so let's move on to our second story, which does cover the G20, but more importantly, the QE tapering that's going on right now from the US Federal Reserve. I'll take this next story from ibtimes.co.uk. The headline reads, China warns US Fed Reserve over QE tapering threat to emerging economies. The US Federal Reserve has been warned that it must contemplate the timing and the pace of its planned stimulus taper to prevent any detrimental knock-on effect to emerging market economies. The warning by China's Vice Finance Minister Zhu Guangyao and Central Bank Vice Governor Yi Gang come ahead of the upcoming G20 meeting in Russia. G20 heads of government are expected to discuss the repercussions of tight central bank banking monetary policy on emerging market economies when they meet in St. Petersburg on the 5th and 6th of September. Emerging markets battling higher volatility in capital flows and exchange rates are struggling to handle the capital exodus as US interest rates rise ahead of an expected cutback in the Fed's asset buys. Moving just down a little bit here in the story, James, but the United States, the main currency issuing country, must consider the spillover effect of its monetary policy, especially the opportunity and rhythm of its exit from the ultra-loose monetary policy that it previously has enjoyed. James, I'll be the first to put my hand up and say that my knowledge of the finer mechanisms of global economics are fairly subpar. So I'm going to let you take the lead on this one. But the first thing that came to my mind was, does China's unease about the Fed's QE tapering scheme point to the fragility of the Chinese economy, despite what we're told in the media about the unstoppable rise of the Red Dragon? How do you see China and also India as well, which is a fast rising economy, handling the G20 summit?
Well, I think that's more to the point. China, I think, is speaking up for the emerging economies here, because it's obviously the biggest player at that particular table and one that will be able to bring this to the forefront of the G20 agenda. So I don't think China is, at least on the surface, as concerned about itself as it is about its BRICS partners. So China has a large amount of foreign exchange. It has capital controls, etc., that they think will help stop the outflow of capital that's coming with this QE tapering. But as people who've been reading my subscriber newsletter will know, India has very much felt the brunt of this. I mean, even the suggestion that the Federal Reserve would start tapering back on their $85 billion a month of Federal Reserve funny money, it has basically started a capital outflow from India that set off set the rupee plunging and plunged India into economic crisis. So it is experiencing some turmoil right now as a direct result of this, and I think China is concerned about that. Obviously, being in that BRICS neighborhood, metaphorically speaking, with India and Brazil and some of the other economies that are hurting because of this idea. And this is part and parcel of being the world reserve currency. I mean, you can have domestic monetary policy, but it's going to have spin-on and knock-on effects all around the world. And for a long time, I mean, America couldn't care less, because it had the military might and everything to back it up. But as the developing economies start to gain steam and gain clout in the global economy, it is something that the Federal Reserve will at least have to take into account. And China will, I'm sure, make sure that happens at the G20. So some very interesting things happening at this G20. In fact, that's exactly what I'm writing about in this weekend's newsletter, so people who subscribe will find out more about what's happening at the G20. And I'll be covering it either in the newsletter or on the program here in the near future.
Yeah. Also, on a related note, one has to wonder what kind of impact this QE tapering will have on TPP negotiations, which are still being pushed by Washington to be finalised and signed off by October. Now, Japan is coming out with some quite strong opposition now that they are at the table, so to speak. Obviously, China not being a part of the TPP, but there still is a significant handful of emerging and struggling Asia-Pacific economies that will feel that potentially will feel a very real impact from this QE tapering. So that's an important point to keep our eyes on as well, I think.
It really is, especially because part of what the TPP deals with is capital controls and puts restrictions on what capital controls countries can put in place, the very capital controls that might put a damper on the effects of this QE tapering. So it really does bind countries' hands. And unfortunately, I think at this point, the globalist leaders that have signed their countries onto this negotiation are probably going to go ahead with a deal in one form or another. But I don't think it'll be in October. I think this is probably going to be delayed. I think there's still a lot to be hammered out. So we'll have to keep our eye on that for next month.
Absolutely so. James, we'll move quickly on to our third and final stories. We're going to do a bit of a whirlwind surveillance state from, once again, my part of the world here around Australia and New Zealand. So while we've all been busy focusing, and rightly so, on Syria, our old friend, however, Edward Snowden, continues to reveal some quite inconvenient truths about this massive spy grid that we're all now steeped in. We'll take this one from Australia's theage.com.au. Australian spies in global deal to tap undersea cables. The nation's electronic espionage agency, the Australian Signals Directorate, is in a partnership with British, American and Singaporean intelligence agencies to tap undersea fiber optic telecommunications cables that link Asia, the Middle East and Europe and carry much of Australia's international phone and internet traffic. Secret information disclosed by United States intelligence whistleblower Edward Snowden has revealed that the British government communications headquarters is collating all data transmitted to and from the UK and Northern Europe via the SEA-ME-WE-3 cable that runs from Japan via Singapore to Djibouti to Suez and to the Straits of Gibraltar to Northern Germany. Australia is connected to this cable by a link from Singapore to Perth, and the GCHQ's bulk interception includes much of Australia's telecommunications and internet traffic with Europe. Sadly, this type of story is not unique at the moment, and we've seen also in New Zealand last week the passing of a domestic spying bill, which is essentially allowing the government to openly domestically spy on its citizens and surveil them. And this was related also to the revelations that the raid that happened on Kin.com's house last year was illegal, but no charges will be laid. So carry on, chaps. One set of rules for the state and one set of rules for us. So as we always see, no accountability and no consequences for those who wish to control us. And of course, coming back more locally here, we also do have the G20 summit next year here in Brisbane to look forward to, and we're seeing yet further increases to police search and seizure powers for people they deem to be suspicious, whatever that means. Not to mention the recently revealed exclusion zone, which encompasses virtually all of Brisbane's CBD. And there is a photo up there on apperspective.net, and it really is a huge exclusion zone. So you really have to stand back and look at where we are as a society, and when this happens now, when our world's misleaders decide to have a chat, the kind of Orwellian police state that's erected in whatever city they decide to meet in. But, you know, that seems to be what happens when you allow a bunch of sociopaths, otherwise known as a state, to have authority over how and why we live our lives. So on somewhat of a positive note, though, I feel that slowly but surely people are waking up to the illusion of government and are beginning to see things through other viable alternatives. The lies and manipulation of government and the media really is becoming more transparent with each new step that the establishment takes. You know, it reveals itself. So think what you will about Mr. Snowden, the fallout from his leaks is still being felt by the global spymasters, and that can only be a good thing, in my opinion.
Well, I agree, and I mean, one of the important things you mentioned there is the double standard. Of course, I mean, if you and I break any sort of law, we're going to jail and they're going to throw the book at us. But if the government comes and flies helicopters onto your property, breaks down your door and illegally hauls you off to prison, no one so much as gets called to the table for that. So it's really ridiculous, I mean, on its face. And I think we're all beginning to understand this in the exact same way as with the revelations about tapping the underseas cables. I mean, at this point, I'm pretty sure everyone understands that every intelligence agency is doing as much as it possibly can to snap up as much data as it possibly can. And I think we should all proceed on that assumption. But I don't want to take away from the importance of these confirmations of these various pieces of the puzzle, because again, it is important to have this documented and on the record for that time when we really do bring the criminals to account and actually try them in a court of law, with a jury of their peers, and they are convicted of their crimes, war crimes and others. And we all have to understand that day can come, and it is coming, and we have to work towards that as people do break down and shatter the illusions that come with that garb of governmental power. Obviously a lot to say there, but I think we'll wrap it up there. Brock, again, incredibly important things happening in the Asia Pacific region all the time, and you are working diligently on it at apperspective.net, and I understand you're going to be making a fall trip to Japan.
That's correct. So this will be our last episode before we vacate the country for a few weeks, and my wife and I are lucky enough to be able to meet up with your good self and your family to catch up. And we do have some things in the pipeline, and we're kind of brainstorming right now what we're going to do. So people can look forward to something coming out anyway in October. So, very much looking forward to that. And, yeah, thanks for having me on again, James. It's always a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to having you here. So safe journey, and we'll talk to you next month. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks, James. See you then.